Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For 18 days, spanning late January and early February, thousands upon thousands of Egyptians took to Tahrir Square to protest their government under President Hosni Mubarak. In the end, Mubarak resigned, but not before thousands were injured and reportedly hundreds died. The military has taken over and promised to bring democracy to Egypt, but nothing is certain, and that's having ramifications around the world. Joining us for a few minutes is James Zogby. He's president and founder of the Arab American Institute and author of Arab Values, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you, Ann. The book is actually called Arab Voices, What
They Are
Saying to Us and Why It Matters. Well, that just gave me a chance to get an extra plug.
Way to make it work for you, Jim. The military is in control with popular backing, apparently. But what can we expect in terms of them providing or making good on the promises of democratic elections?
Well, look, there are two forces here. There's this military that is the state and has been the state for 60 years. There have been presidents, three, but it is the military that is the backbone. They're a government unto themselves. The question is now, does this rather irresistible force that was mobilized in the streets that overturned the president and his government and now turned control to the military, will this irresistible force stop or will they continue to push forward demanding that the military make good on the promises that were made prior to Mubarak's leaving? That is, a new constitution, a fully democratic process, and space for political parties to operate. If that's the case, this will have a wonderful outcome. If it's not the case, we may see more pressure and more tension in the months to come.
Might the military have learned, however, that they could face the same sort of problems that Mubarak did in the end?
The military wasn't tested in this. They took a very cautious and backseat role. After the police learned their lesson and unfortunately ended up killing many, many people, the police were pulled off of the streets and the military was there. People looked at the military as their friend, and the military behaved that way, creating space for the demonstrators until at the very end when it became clear that the demonstrators were going to pour out beyond the square and march to Mubarak's home. At that point, the military said, enough's enough, Mubarak, this is it, finish, you're done. The question, though, is the military, in effect, got away easy. They didn't establish a red line. The red lines weren't crossed, and so there wasn't any confrontation. Will the military cede enough political space to meet the needs of this newly empowered people? And I think that's the one really exciting thing here. Egyptians and people even beyond Egypt are feeling a sense of control, a sense of identity with this revolution that they created, that they maintained as peaceful, that they maintained with enormous humor and just wonderful good spirit. And they're not, I think, going to just surrender this easily. And so we've got what we had from the beginning. The state is there. The revolution is there. And how much space does the state create to meet the needs of the revolution?
I heard an interesting analysis this morning on BBC. The government in Iran is saying that this is that the protesters in Egypt took a page from the book of 1979 and the revolution there, and the folks protesting the government in Iran said no, they took a page from our book in 2009 when we were protesting.
It's actually true in both cases. I remember that revolution in 79. Mm-hmm. It was a joyful event. It was peaceful, and I think we celebrated it all over the world. I was a member of a group at the time, the Committee for Artistic and Intellectual Freedom in Iran, and it was just an amazing moment to see this peaceful revolution bring down the Shah and the military. But there was a counter-revolution that was led then by the Ayatollah that turned into a rather bloody and doctrinaire affair where they then purged from those who led this nonviolent revolution, all of those who were liberals and secularists and imposed a kind of almost Stalinist discipline that was an Islamic Stalinist discipline. If you didn't toe the line, you were purged from universities and from the workplace, etc. the counter-revolution to the counter-revolution in 2009 mm-hmm. was, again, a largely peaceful and largely joyful affair that was squashed by the Ayatollah's folks. So the question right now is, you know, will Egypt go the way of 79, that is to say, give way to this ugly, dark affair? I don't think so. It's not in the Egyptian character, and the Muslim Brotherhood is very different than the Ayatollah and his crew. So I have much greater hope for Egypt than that. But I think both sides were right. The thing is that the government in Iran is wrong in claiming itself heirs of that 79 revolution. They were actually the people who stole that revolution.
In a recent column in the Huffington Post, you were critical of the reactions by a bevy of U.S. lawmakers and politicians. What about the Obama administration? What about their reaction to all of this? And what difference does the American reaction make anyway at this point in the process?
Well, it doesn't make a whole lot. And I mm-hmm. think from the beginning, there was a little too much of this self-absorption. We either thought it was all about us or it was all about Israel. And I said from the beginning that people in Tahrir Square weren't waiting for America to sprinkle holy water on them. They were doing what they were doing. This was an Egyptian affair. I also said, and I think it was true, that when I got asked a question by a reporter, are we unpopular in Egypt because of our support for Mubarak, and will this make us improve our standing if we dump him? And I said, he's unpopular because he supported us. We're not unpopular because we supported him. He was delegitimized by years of support for policies that people in Egypt felt were just intolerable. The support for the war in Iraq, the support for Israel squashing Palestinians in Gaza, the failure of the government to raise a peep when rendition and torture policies ran through their country. That was the way we ran rendition, was we ran a lot of it through Egypt. And so, I think that we have some rethinking to do about how we deal with the region. We just can't say you should be Democrats, like George Bush said, and then pursue policies that delegitimize governments and alienate us from people. We need a revolution here in how we approach the Middle East and how we think about its peoples. And that's why my book, Arab Voices, those voices demand to be listened to. We cannot have a dialogue where we're talking at people. We've got to listen. And I think the people of Egypt today deserve the right to be heard. And we need to pay close attention to what they're saying and be able to respond more effectively, I think, than the administration did in the first, especially several days. I think at the end, the president got it right, but we had a meander for a while until we figured it out.
We have a few more minutes left with our guest this hour, James Zagby. He is president of the American Arab Institute. He's also author of Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, and get those calls in quickly. If you'd like to speak with Jim Zagby, you're welcome. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. But do it quickly. Jim's only with us for about five more minutes. Not everybody is celebrating. There were people that supported not just political people either, people in the Egyptian society that supported
sure.
President Mubarak.
Sure.
What's the sense about how Egyptians will handle that kind of conflict?
Well, I don't think it will erupt into conflict because the movement was so nonviolent and it was not a striking out in anger, even at the government. They wanted change. They wanted space. These were young people who are Egyptian to the core and wanted to be able to grow in their own country and not have the only opportunity available to them, the fact that they would leave and go someplace else and prosper. And so, you know, you had parents on one side of this and kids on the other side. Mm-hmm. But I think the parents and the kids will easily reconcile because they see that the future of their country is what's at stake right now. And they all, I think, right now see the possibility of a brighter future. But look, Hosni Mubarak was a hero. He did, in fact, establish a very open society for a period of time after the assassination of Anwar Sadat, and an opening of the economy for a period of time. But 30 years and a strangling of the economy and a looting of the economy and cronies that had taken too much and not looked back has taken a toll. And with that, a lot of repression. And you now see some people living with the memory of the past and some kids saying, you know, those few years in the early part aren't good enough. We want good years now, and so we want change. And so that's what I think this is about. But I think the Egyptian people will not turn against each other at all.
I watched the 60 Minutes interview with the Google executive, the Egyptian Google executive, and it made me wonder, the question was asked of him, are you going to run for office or do you see yourself playing a role in the transition? And he said, not at all. He wants to get back to work. And you wonder, well, who does fill this vacuum?
Well, I think that's what we'll see. There clearly are some wonderful people in the country that I've known, including people who were in the ruling party and had no other option politically to participate. But, you know, it's going to take time to create alternative party structures. And this young man may change his mind. But right now, the organizations do not exist. There is only the ruling party and a few decayed opposition parties that have been around for decades and have sort of gotten used to being the teeny-weeny minority opposition party that was there so that the government could say we have an opposition party. I think new structures will emerge, will be created, and that is something that we'd have to look to for the next 6 months. That's why this isn't going to happen overnight. It is going to take time, but I think these kids were creative enough to do what they did. It was amazing to see what they did. And it was funny, and it was the discipline and the communication skills they showed. Now they have to translate that into organizing a political force, and I think they're capable of it, easily capable of it.
Cade, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You wanted to talk about the Muslim Brotherhood?
Are you speaking to me?
I'm sorry, Omar. The name's Cade, but go ahead. Sorry.
Hi, Jim. I'm so glad to hear you on Ann Fisher. I listen to her all the time. I had a quick question. Could you speak just a moment to dictators such as Hosni Mubarak, but how they crush kind of moderate, liberalized political forces in their said countries, and I heard you speaking to this just a moment ago, allow groups to survive that have more extremist points of view, such as the Muslim Brotherhood relative to Egypt, of course, so that they can come back to Western nations and peddle a narrative, me or them, a dictatorship or a extremist agenda.
The Muslim Brotherhood was banned. It existed in different forms, but as an official party, it wasn't able to function for many, many years. I think that what we're not going to know, because we simply don't know right now, is how strong a base the Muslim Brotherhood has, one, and two, what is the character of this party? But what I also know is that those, like, you know, members of Congress who say, yes, we want an Egyptian democracy and it's a great idea, but we can't have that party in power, and anyone who runs for office has to take an oath, as one member of Congress, a leading member of Congress, Republican member, said, that anyone who runs should take an oath that they support the Jewish state of Israel and peace with Israel. Well, that's not a democracy. You know, we can't define, as the regime defined, what are the requirements of participating in democracy. Everybody has to participate. I think that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is going to be very Egyptian. I don't think it's at all going to be Iranian or extremist in any way, shape, or form. I also think that the numbers are going to be a lot lower than people expect them to be. I don't think this is going to be a majoritarian party. But the point is, we have to – the price of democracy is everyone competes, everyone plays, and the victor wins. I think that the character of Egyptian society is such that I am very confident that it is going to be a freewheeling, open process without extremists running the show, because the Egyptian people simply are not inclined that way.
Omar, sorry about your name, and thanks for the call. Jim, we're out of time. I want to thank you, James Zogby, for joining us today.
Thank you, and very much for having this conversation at a very important time.
That's James Zogby. He's president and founder of the Arab American Institute. He's also author of Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is on this afternoon from 2 until 4, right here on 89.7 NPR News. And I'm midday host Amy Jurevich saying thank you to everyone who pledged their support during the 89.7 NPR News Winter Membership Drive. The drive was a great success thanks to your generous contributions. Your membership keeps NPR News, local news, and great programs like All Signs with Ann Fisher on the radio for all of Central Ohio. If you missed the chance to give, you can still do so at WOSU.org. Thank you for supporting the new 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at GoodHealthColumbus.org.
41 degrees in downtown Columbus, a slight chance of rain today, cloudy skies and temperatures falling to around 38 this afternoon. Clouds tonight and a low of 22 degrees. Sunshine tomorrow, a high of 43. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and happy 199th birthday to the city of Columbus. But what of its bicentennial next year? Coming up later, we're going to talk with Jamie Green. He's the program manager for the Bicentennial Commemoration of Columbus, and also Christy Angel. She's the co-chair of the Bicentennial Initiatives Committee. We'll learn the distinctions between those two and more. First, we welcome local historian Ed Lentz to talk about the last big celebration 100 years ago and more. Ed, welcome to the program.
Always a pleasure.
First of all, what's the conflict? I've noticed, online and on the internet, there's a little disagreement about when the actual bicentennial of the city of Columbus is or should be.
And it's all my fault.
Okay. I guess, as usual, we've booked the right people today.
Yes. In a previous life, I was the executive director of the Columbus Landmarks Foundation. And in 1984, we were looking for a way to sort of celebrate the city. And it occurred to me that in 1834, what was then the borough of Columbus, which had been around for a long time, since 1816, became the city of Columbus because 5,000 people had arrived in town because of the arrival of the Ohio Canal and the National Road and all that other good stuff. And so the birthday of Columbus as a city, a legal city of 5,000 people, is in 1834. So its 150th anniversary was in 1984. So we threw a little party over at City Hall with a birthday cake and the whole thing to celebrate 150 years of Columbus being a city, which is not when the town was founded. The town was founded by the Ohio General Assembly on February 14th, 1812, establishing the high banks opposite Franklinton at the forks of the Scioto, known as Wolf's Ridge, as the new capital for the state of Ohio, which had previously been at Chillicothe and Zanesville and back to Chillicothe and all that sort of thing. So the official birthday of Columbus as the capital of Ohio is February 14th, 1812. And our 200th birthday is coming up exactly 1 year from today.
Now, the whole 5,000 thing, that's because the state charter, the state constitution or something.
Yeah, the definition of a city in Ohio is places of 5,000 people or more. That's what it was at the time. So when you get 5,000 people, you become a city. And you reorganize yourself and restructure yourself and your city government changes. And if we want to go into the obscurities of archaic city government in Ohio, we don't want to go there.
No, obscurities. No obscurities allowed. But
that's the reason.
That's the reason. Okay, so there are two dates, and the one that—
Well, you could use another date if you want, when Columbus becomes a borough.
Start messing with people's heads.
I just think it's easier to use the original first date when the capital city is created, which is what exactly was done in 1962 when we celebrated our 150th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And in 1912, when we celebrated our 100th anniversary. So we have a little precedent for all this.
Well, speaking of 1912.
There you go.
What did Columbus do to celebrate its 100th anniversary?
It threw a very big party.
Mm-hmm. Just one day?
No. Okay. It lasted for a considerable period of time, and it was tied in with the celebration of the Ohio State Fair. A little bit of background on this. Columbus, like most places, not only in Ohio but across the country, did not really celebrate anniversaries all that much in its first century. So we didn't do much on our 25th anniversary or our 50th or even our 75th. But the world changed, especially after the Great Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia of the United States in 1876. This country went on a centennial binge, I think is the easiest way to describe it. They included things like the Great Columbian Exposition in 1893, and we had the Louisiana Purchase Exposition in 1904, and we had the Jamestown Exposition in 1907. So we were getting used to having these rather elaborate kinds of centennial and bicentennial and tricentennial kinds of celebrations. So as the date approached for Columbus's, as early as 1907, people started talking about, gee, we ought to do something for the centennial. And like most things, it took a couple, 3 years for people to finally start doing something about the centennial. And they did. They organized a rather elaborate planning committee and planned a wide variety of events. In those days, when we didn't have television and we didn't have the internet and we didn't have radio, for that matter, they had movies, but they were pretty crude back in those days. The way people celebrated was with parades and pageants. So we had a whole big set of floats coming down the street with people in appropriate costume and garb for whatever period in Columbus history they were supposed to represent, mm-hmm. and this sort of thing, and notable celebrities of local and state fame coming along. And there were other events as well throughout that period, but it lasted over a pretty significant period of time. The Columbus Dispatch put out a centennial edition, which actually is more like a book or a magazine, actually, than a newspaper, in celebration of the event. And songs were commissioned. All kinds of stuff were done, and it was quite a party. The city was decked out and elaborately decorated for the event. And I think people came away from it feeling pretty good about themselves and about their city.
My guest is Ed Lentz, the historian, and we're talking about the fact that exactly a year from today, Columbus celebrates its 200th anniversary of its founding. If you have a question or comment, we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about this. We'll also be talking with some of the event organizers, the folks who are planning the bicentennial celebration. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a question or comment for Ed Lentz, you might want to do that right away, although, Ed, you will be with us for the rest of the hour. So what are the must-be-remembered moments of Columbus history? If the organizers blow this, what will they have blown? I mean, if they don't get this and take notes.
There are a lot of important moments in Columbus history, and I don't think we can cover them all in 15 minutes.
No.
But I think it's worthwhile to dwell on the creation of a city. You've got to keep in mind that Columbus is a created city. There was no city here until the Ohio General Assembly brought it into being on February 14, 1812. There was a little town across the river called Franklinton that had been around since 1797, and there were a couple of people who were sort of illegally living in log cabins on this side of the river. But most of the land was still open because it was a place called the Refugee Tract. It ran from Fifth Avenue on the north to Refugee Road on the south and east for a considerable distance and had been set aside for people from Nova Scotia, of all places, who had lost property in the American Revolution. Of course, most of them never made it here. They sold their land, warrants, to land speculators.
Are there any pockets of Nova Scotians anywhere?
Yes, there are. Truro Township around Reynoldsburg is named for Truro Township in Nova Scotia. And there are some original residents out there in Truro Township who actually came here from Nova Scotia, tailors and so on. Mm-hmm. But the capital itself being brought into being is a major event in the creation of the city. The Civil War is another heavily important event. Columbus is a little town. of 18,000 people. It's a railhead, but it's essentially a small Midwestern capital city. And then the decision is made in the Civil War to build Camp Chase out on the west side of the city as a mobilization and training center for 26,000 Union troops. And it also becomes a place where we build a small, modest prison camp for Confederate prisoners, designed to hold about 2,000 Confederate prisoners. By 1864, there are 10,000 of them there, and a lot of them are dying there. A lot of them are still buried there in the Camp Chase Cemetery, one of the largest of its kind in the country. Moving down a little farther, Columbus goes through a major industrial boom around the turn of the century because of the opening of the Hocking Valley Railroad, which brings huge quantities, coal, iron, lumber, to the city. So by the turn of the century, we're the buggy capital of the world. 22 buggy companies based out of Columbus. We try to make the adaptation to the motor car. Some of these companies end up making cars for a while. But in the long run, Detroit, rather than Columbus, sort of becomes more of the motor city than we do, although those companies do last for a long time. World War II and its effect on the town is a major effect. We had basically rode the Depression out better than most cities of our size because of our diversified economy. But we still were pretty bad shape. And then Curtis Wright came to town to build a small, intimate factory that employed 25,000 people to build airplanes. And all sorts of people came to Columbus looking for jobs. A lot of those folks were from Appalachia. By the end of the war, about 30% of our population is new folks from Appalachia, black and white. It's probably the greatest single migration to the city since the German and Irish migrations in the 19th century. And, of course, Columbus has always had a larger than most other cities' percentage of its population as a black population. That's not unique to Columbus. That's true of a lot of capital cities because they're service cities. There's lots of jobs for folks. And also it's no accident either that Columbus is a major switching station on the Underground Railroad, which is, of course, neither underground nor a railroad, but is a network by which runaway slaves were able to escape to freedom. And basically the rule of thumb used to be that if you could make it to Columbus, you'd probably make it the rest of the way. Lots of those sites on the Underground Railroad can still be found around the city. So those are just a few points of major
What about
events.
In maybe recent history, like in the last 50 years, what would be something that you wouldn't want? Well, of course, the war. You mentioned the World War II.
Well, also, I think Columbus becomes a model for the new kind of city in the Midwest. If you take a look at Columbus's economy in the years after World War II, our economy is much more like that of cities like Indianapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City, Atlanta, and while many other cities in Ohio that were predominantly industrial cities, Cleveland, Youngstown, Akron, Toledo, Cincinnati, begin to suffer grievously because of the shift in our economy. Columbus, on the other hand, is a model for a newer kind of economy. If you look at the companies that come to our city, that are developed in our city, in the years after World War II, partly because of the presence of the Ohio State University, the Battelle Memorial Institute, the largest private research organization of its kind in the world. Look at some of these other kinds of companies that come into being. Chemical Abstracts decides to locate here in Columbus near Ohio State. OCLC, the Library Cataloging Center, locates here as well. The Limited. Worthington Steel, which is an interesting sort of company in the way of the new manufacturing that's beginning to be developed around the country. You put them all together, combined with Columbus still being a major center of transportation and trade. Look how many trucking depots are located within close proximity to Columbus. Columbus is still a major rail center as well. We don't think about it too much before anymore because passenger rail has declined. But just count the number of trains that go through this town on the average day. You put it all together, we have a highly successful, highly diversified economy that provided a model. I mean, one way you can look at some of the history of Ohio in the course of the last 40 or 50 years is a lot of other cities around Ohio are trying very hard to become like Columbus. And some of them are succeeding, too. I mean, to be fair about it, a lot of cities in Ohio have begun to successfully make the transformation to this new, diversified, post-industrial society that we are beginning to move into.
One of the things we're starting to appreciate more and more about Columbus are its neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And, of course, WOSU is producing that series of documentaries, next of which, well, the first one was on the Short North, the next one in German Village. The next one coming up is the King Lincoln District. It airs on April 19th at 9 p.m., but that's going to be part of the emphasis as well.
Yeah, I think Columbus is an interesting town in a number of ways, not the least of which is we grew extraordinarily rapidly in size and population in the years since World War II, making us now the largest city in land area in the state. In the process of doing that, we not only preserved our tax base as a major urban area, we also now find ourselves with the widest variety of neighborhoods in the city, some old, some new, some historical, some not. You put it all together, and it's a fabric of life that's well worth describing, and that's what the WOSU series, Columbus Neighborhoods, is trying to do. We do it through a website, columbusneighborhoods.org, in which any neighborhood can come onto that site and show examples of pictures and stories and whatever. And in that sense, what we're trying to do is bring together in one place a way to look at neighborhood a little closely, more closely.
And conversely, Columbus is more than just a collection of its neighborhoods. You mentioned Reynoldsburg. It goes out farther. It affects the suburbs as well. I mean, it's not – where do you draw that line?
Well, I don't draw the line. I like to think basically of Central Ohio and the way the fabric of these communities meld with each other regardless of their necessary political boundary lines. Westerville and Columbus have a lot in common. Worthington and Columbus, Arlington, Bexley, and so on, all have a great deal in common with Columbus. It is a unified regional network of people and neighborhoods. If you want to understand Columbus, you've got to understand those neighborhoods. We are more than just our downtown, significantly more.
We're talking about what's coming up next year when Columbus celebrates its 200th anniversary, or the 200th anniversary of its founding. If you have a question or comment, join us, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to meet a couple of the folks who are helping organize the bicentennial celebration of the founding of Columbus, so you can join that conversation as well. My guest so far has been Ed Lentz. He's going to stay with us, a local historian. Ed Lentz, if you have a question or comment for him, he will remain in the studio throughout the program. So have no fear. We have to take a quick break right now. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon right here on 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and we'll hear about a unique collaboration between Ohio State University and the Royal Shakespeare Company to bring Shakespeare into Central Ohio classrooms. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11 here on 89.7.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting the off-Broadway solo work Let Me Down Easy by Anna Deavere Smith, star of Nurse Jackie in the West Wing, February 22nd through the 27th at the Lincoln Theater. Tickets at wexarts.org.
41 degrees in downtown Columbus. A chance of rain today. Temperatures also falling today to 38 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 22. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. Today is the 199th birthday of the founding of the city of Columbus. And looking ahead, we're talking about Columbus's upcoming bicentennial celebration in 2012. Already with us, Ed Lentz, local historian. Also joining us now is Jamie Green. He's the program manager for the Bicentennial Commemoration of Columbus. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Thank you, Ann.
And with us, Christy Angel. She is the co-chair of the Bicentennial Initiatives Committee. Christy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ian.
I guess what we ought to do is say right away, what's the diff between the Bicentennial Commemoration of Columbus and the Bicentennial Initiatives Committee?
The commemoration is really meant to describe the entire program, and the program has three components. Initiatives is one of those components, promotions is one of those components, and celebrations is one of those components. There's an organizing committee chaired by Ty Marsh, mm-hmm. sort of overseeing that. Christy happens to be the chair of one of those three program committees.
Okay. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want to join that conversation. So, Jamie and Christy, how long have you been working on the project?
As Ed had made reference to in the centennial, there was a group of people that started several years out. So in 2007, Mayor Coleman organized the Bicentennial Commission, the largest commission ever organized in the city's history, over 200 individuals. And those individuals started an effort to create a vision for the future of Columbus around the Bicentennial. That culminated in 2008. And then about 9 months ago, Mayor Coleman called together other civic leaders, and we started the process of planning the commemoration. So for about the last 9 months, this more detailed planning about how to celebrate this important time in the city's history really started to get much more detailed.
So in your conversations, what did you figure is your primary goal?
Well, the primary goal of the Bicentennial, as seen by the Organizing Committee and the Mayor, is really to use the Bicentennial to lift community pride. Ed listed a number of important assets we've had historically that are still here today that make us, you know, a very special place. And so one of the things that we found in 2007 and 2008 is that the Columbus community is a confident, but they don't really express it. You know, as the mayor has said various times, you know, we're lacking that swagger that, you know, a really strong city might want to have. And so we really want to use the Bicentennial as an opportunity to take stock of the great assets that we have here in this community, help people understand a common story about what the city is today and what it can become. So the community pride is very important, and we really see it as sort of the launching pad for the larger economic ambitions of Central Ohio, really connecting it to the Columbus 2020 initiative, the economic development piece, but really seeing our work integrated very tightly with that. So community pride is very important to us as a core objective.
How has the recession put a damper on things? I know the city's committed a couple hundred thousand or $300,000.
Right. Oh, yeah, over $300,000 has been committed by the city. What we have found is that the recession, particularly in the fall of 2008 and in 2009, was very difficult, especially for the city. But with the passage of the income tax, it certainly helped local government a great deal, the city of Columbus. We have found a number of our corporate leaders and the Columbus Foundation, the partnership, being very supportive of us so far. So there is an ongoing fundraising effort right now. But so far, we've found the community to be open and welcoming and seeing the importance of this activity. One thing, Anne, I would like to point out is that, you know, in some cities, you know, they might have a celebration like this, and it might last a week. It might last maybe a month. But the leaders in this community want to use the entire year from first night to first night to really lift up the community. So in terms of thinking about events and programs, we're programming, you know, 12 months worth.
Audrey, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi. I'm calling from Cincinnati, but I grew up in Worthington.
Oh, okay.
So let me give a shout out to Worthington.
Okay.
And I wanted to hear some of your wonderful experts talk about the contribution of gay tolerance in Columbus. It's been a big deal, and it's, I think, made a huge cultural and economic impact on the city. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Audrey. Yeah, I mean, Columbus is considered a very gay-friendly community.
Absolutely.
Right. And I'll yes.
Thank you, Audrey.
Yeah. And if I could, the work in 2007 and 2008, there were 13 topics as part of that work. One of those was the image and marketing of the community that was led by one of the focus groups that was really trying to look at what was the essence of this community. And there have been several times over the years when we've tried to figure out our identity and image and a tagline. But what this group did was spend almost 3 years using the thousands of comments that came from the public and trying to get to the essence of what this community is about. And it came down from a lot of research to two words, and that was about being smart and open. And the smart really reflects the intellectual, the knowledge-based economy that we have here with Ohio State, Battelle, et cetera. But the open was really related to the tolerance and the acceptance of people that are different, the gay and lesbian community being one of those. And so one of the lenses that everything that Christy and I are doing, the folks at Experience Columbus, the folks at Greater Columbus Arts Council are doing, everything that we're doing is being filtered through this notion of smart and open. We want to continue to send that message. This is an open and tolerant place. And we've got the evidence that it already is, but we want to actually lift that up even more. So in the coming months, as you and your listeners start to see promotional material about the Bicentennial and they see promotional material about the city of Columbus, they will see in a really unprecedented way this essence about being open. We realize that that's an important part of our community that Audrey mentioned, and we're very proud of it, and we want to continue to promote it.
Christy Angel, tell us about the initiatives that you're hoping to launch in a year from now.
Sure. Well, Ann, first let me just talk about there are three committees. So the first committee is the Promotions Committee, and that's the committee that really looks at the marketing, the internal and external marketing of our community that Jamie just spoke about. The Celebration Committee is chaired by the Greater Columbus Arts Council, and it is looking at the celebrations that we will have from first night to first night in 2012. And then the Initiatives Committee, which is we're the committee that is guiding the initiatives agenda. So initiatives, think of them as programs mm-hmm. and projects that will come to life, that are already started, some that will begin with Shovel to Ground in 2012. But those are the initiatives that we're guiding that agenda for the overarching Bicentennial Committee. So right now our work is, we have quite a bit of work ahead of us. There are hundreds of initiatives planned for 2012, some that have already begun, as I said, some that where the shovel will go in the ground in 2012. And so we're looking at all of those initiatives through a lens of those 13 topics that Jamie just mentioned. And we are looking at how do we categorize them? How do we determine which one of those initiatives are supported by the Bicentennial Committee and are branded as the official Bicentennial kind of projects and programs? Then we're looking at registered, and we're looking at those are things that are taking place. They need to be celebrated. They need to be lifted up. They'll be registered and then acknowledged. And it's also important to mention that we are kind of celebrating, if you think about 2012 in thirds, we are celebrating our past, our history, in the first third of the year. In the second third of the year, we're celebrating our present, our presence, where we are today, and mm-hmm. we will be in 2012. And in that last third of 2012, we will be celebrating our future.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Scott, you're on the air. You have a question I wanted to get to, so I'll let you ask it.
Yeah. Are you going to have local bands and support live entertainment mm-hmm. From the region? And if so, I do an event called Chubstock. I have about 40 bands that have flocked from the Midwest, Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, and we have great talent mm-hmm. supported. The arts and music.
Okay. Thanks, Scott, for that call. So what about using local talent and developing that?
That is really fundamental to what we're doing. I mean, I think it would fundamentally be hypocritical for us to have a celebration and import talent when, you know, one of our brand essence is being smart. So it is our intention to lift up the local talent and that we have here. Scott, we have mapped out a year-long program of local events that we have, and many of them have a musical dimension to them. So if you've got some ideas, one of the messages I think we'd want to give you and other listeners today is that we've talked about a committee structure, but this is very much an open process. We've got an initiatives list that Christy mentioned that grows almost daily, and ideas about ways to commemorate grow daily. So, Scott, if you've got some ideas at some point, and I hope we have a way they can get to us.
Is there a website?
There is a.
There is, tell us what that is.
The website. There are a couple of things. One, there is a Facebook page called Columbus Bicentennial. Columbus Bicentennial.
Okay.
In terms of the actual website, it's columbus2012.org.
Okay. Columbus2012.org. And also a link to the Columbus Bicentennial Facebook page. We'll post both of those on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And Scott, thanks for that question. It's one of the things I loved about the documentaries that the WOSU has done on the neighborhoods is the use of local talent and local music. It's made it richer for that. Christy, when you talk about the future, are you talking about it in terms of promoting the city into the future? Is that what you mean by that, or what?
Well, all three of our committees will be looking at the bicentennial in these thirds. So we, celebrations, marketing, and the initiatives. When we think about the initiatives committee, though, we're talking about projects and programs. So things that might begin, that might be launched, that might
like
open,
educational type of programs?
Through those 13 subject matter areas. I mean, it can be educational. There are some things associated with mobility issues, moving people, green initiatives. I mean, there are just a host of things that we're looking at. We are not ready to announce the initiatives yet, but we're getting closer.
That's what I really want to know.
I'll have to come back and share that with you.
Yeah. And there are some extraordinary things, though, happening in the city that are related to 2012. I mean, right now as we speak, the Children's Hospital has a major event downtown, and their, very, very significant expansion opens in 2012. So we're gonna lift that up. The new convention hotel that's happening, it's opening in 2012. So there are a lot of these things that are happening that are on a list that we know about. Curb-wide, recycling, the mayor's program that was very, very important in 2007, 2008 is going to start in 2012. So there are some specifics.
Carolyn, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Carolyn. No? Carolyn? Oh. She must have hung up. Sorry, Carolyn. 614-292-8513. We have about 5 minutes or 4 minutes left. If you want to make a quick call, we'll try to get you on. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, and my guests are Christy Angel, co-chair of the Columbus Bicentennial Committee, and also Jamie Green. He's program coordinator for the Columbus Bicentennial Program. He's coordinator for the Columbus Bicentennial Program. 614-292-8513 if you want to get that call in right now. How are you working with the schools, or what are your plans about working with the schools to fulfill that goal of education?
One of the objectives that we have is to make sure that young people are involved in this process from preschool, P through 16 is what we've said. So we have representatives from the Columbus City Schools in our committees that are working on curriculum opportunities for young people. They're also working on ways for them to document their own experience as part of the bicentennial. They are also connected to the Education Council here. So it's not, we have, about 13 different school districts serving our students in our city. So we very much are reaching out to them. The college age population is very important to us as well. Some of your listeners may know that Columbus is reported to be second only to Boston in the per capita number of college students that exist here. And in the fall of 2012, one of the new events that has not happened before in the city will be something called College Fest. Ohio State and Columbus State will be on semesters for the first time in 2012. They'll be back here before Labor Day. And so there's a plan to really welcome them here, but also to do this such in a way that they get immersed in the community and maybe think differently about wanting to stay here. And to your earlier caller, Scott, I imagine this College Fest with 9 institutions will have some music as part of it. So there may be a good opportunity for Scott there.
Ed, 100 years ago, mm-hmm. or 99 years ago, or 101 years ago, I can't remember. I'm
way back
remember.
Then.
Yeah,
yes.
Way back. And was it primarily just a big party? Was there all this thought put into initiatives and looking to the future and that sort of thing?
I think there was. There was considerable discussion about what could be done in the long run about the city. You may recall or know that in 1908, the city had undertaken its first really significant city plan, the 1908 city plan, which began as a plan to do nothing more than preserve parks in the city, but went beyond that and started talking about a redevelopment of a civic center for downtown. It would take a long time, but that conversation was continuing. 1912 was a period at the height of the progressive movement in our country. Ohio had a constitutional convention in 1912. That's when home rule came in. We also adopted the initiative recall and referendum in that year as well. So progressive change was on a lot of people's minds as they were living through the centennial, which was taking place as all these other events were happening as well. And it wasn't just a big party and a bunch of parades. There were a wide variety of other cultural and social events. There was a major exhibition where people were asked to bring in, if you had great-grandpa's flintlock musket that was here at the creation of the town, they had a huge exhibition of borrowed and lent items. Mm-hmm. My only great regret was they didn't take pictures or keep most of those borrowed or lent items, because I would love to see a few of them around today for the 200th mm-hmm. anniversary. It's one thing we're trying to do more this time out is help document things a little bit better than probably was done 100 years ago.
That's all the time we have for now. I'm sure we're going to have more shows about this as the year progresses and the plans take shape. I want to thank my guest this hour, Christy Angel. Christy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Look forward to hearing those initiatives.
That's right. We'll
all righty. And Jamie Green, also of the Columbus Bicentennial Program. Jamie, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Ann.
And Ed Lentz, as always, local historian extraordinaire. Thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for listening on 89.7 NPR News.